And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Tuesday, February the 2nd, 2016. It's Groundhog Day, and here in Ohio, Buckeye Chuck said there are going to be six more weeks of winter, but Puxatony Phil said it's going to be an early spring. So I guess just pick your choice and go with what you want as far as the groundhogs go. But we've got a great two-hour program here today. As you know, last night were the Iowa caucuses, and boy, oh boy, was there a lot of surprises going into that as opposed to what the pollsters said. Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton in a virtual tie on the Democratic side, but Ted Cruz pulled it out by quite a rate over Donald Trump, and Marco Rubio came out of nowhere to third place and almost passed Donald Trump for second place. So a lot to talk about with the Iowa caucuses. Coming up in hour number two today, we're going to be joined by 40th Treasurer of the United States under President Bill Clinton, Mary Ellen Withrow, to give her thoughts on last night's event. But in this hour, we have a lot to talk about because we've got a gentleman who is a journalist. He worked with Edward R. Murrow. He was the teacher of Bill O'Reilly. How about that? He was on Nixon's enemies list, and he has written a great new book, and I've gotten into this in the last couple weeks, Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War. We're going to talk about the book, Iowa, and this man's fantastic career. Former host of Meet the Press as well. What credentials this guy has. Marvin Kalb. Marvin, how are you?
I am fine, Scott. Nice to be with you.
Marvin, I want to get right to the breaking news from last night. What was your take on the Iowa caucuses?
Well, there were a couple of things, and you've already mentioned some of them, but for me, the put-down of Donald Trump was, I think, terribly important. Trump had entered the Iowa race almost determined that he was going to win. He was going to prove to everybody that he was not a fluke, that he was the real thing. And, in fact, before the people voted, he was the guy in the lead. And everybody, a lot of the journalists, expected him to win. Well, it turns out that the people in Iowa had a different idea, and Ted Cruz had the better organization, and its organization in Iowa is far more important sometimes than simple personality. And it is an amazing thing. We're going to see what happens up in New Hampshire next week because Trump said in his concession speech last night that he's ahead in the polls by 20-some-odd points. Well, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens next week. That, to me, was simply the most fascinating part of the evening.
What should we believe these polls? Because the poll going in last night had Donald Trump at 31% and winning by quite a steady margin. Not only did he not win, but he did not approach 31% either. What are polls accurate?
Well, that's the question we ask ourselves every time polls disappoint us. For the most part, polling in political operations of this sort have proven to be very, very effective and remarkably accurate. But every now and then they blow it. And they blow it big time because of a number of invariables that come into play. For example, yesterday in Iowa there was the matter of how many people would actually show up. And they had expected 120,000. Well, 155,000 showed up. And that meant a great deal to Ted Cruz, most especially to Marco Rubio, the young senator from Florida, and it meant a great deal to Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. So numbers of that sort can, at the very last minute, invalidate some of the polling data. But that is something that the pollster cannot really put into his calculation. Very difficult to anticipate what the weather is going to be like, how many people are going to show up. And so you go with the best information you've got. Most of the time they're right, but last night they blew it.
Is there anything to be said for the fact that maybe Trump was just entertainment and people said they would vote for him, but when it actually came time to pull that trigger, they just couldn't do it?
Oh, I agree with that completely. I think there are a lot of people in this campaign who have been amused and bemused by Trump, and he certainly has exploited his popularity a great deal in all of his speeches, which it's my curse. I listen to and read quite regularly. He talks primarily about himself and about how wonderful he is. And I suspect that a lot of Americans listening to that are sort of amused, bemused, whatever the right verb is. But when it comes to voting and they ask themselves, this guy is amusing, but should he be president? That kind of question, I'm sure, must have come up in the minds of any number of people from Iowa last night, and they decided, oop, he's interesting, but he's not my choice for president.
Ted Cruz is not well liked by the Republican establishment. Marco Rubio tends to be liked by them somewhat. Do you think now the money trucks are going to back up for Marco Rubio and try to push Ted Cruz out of the way? And is Ted Cruz, once we get out of Iowa, is he viable across the United States?
Well, those are two terrific questions, and we're going to learn, all of us are going to learn a great deal over the next couple of months. My own gut feeling at this point is that Cruz had a perfect constituency in Iowa. There were a lot of evangelicals, there were a lot of religious people. He came through as the son of the minister, as somebody who talked God constantly, and many, many people wanted to hear that. And they felt comfortable in that kind of talk. He also spoke as the anti-establishment figure. And there's a great deal of feeling that one has, judging the American electorate at this point, that they're tired of the establishment, looking for somebody new, not quite certain what that means, who that person would be, perhaps willing to roll the dice and go with somebody who's brand new, perhaps at the very last minute, as they did apparently with Trump in Iowa, pull back from that kind of vote and decide they're not going to run that risk. So we're not sure at this point. There are only a couple of things that are clear. One of them is that a lot of American voters want somebody new, somebody out of the system, somebody who represents change. The other factor that we learn is that don't be under the assumption at all times that what the pollsters tell you, what the pundits tell you, what you read in the newspapers, what you're told on television, is close to the truth. There's an effort to be close to the truth, but you're not necessarily there.
Mike Huckabee suspended his campaign last night.
Yes.
Is there any hope for anybody who did not place in the top three last night? Jeb Bush is still there. Chris Christie, Ben Carson, I think, finished fourth. Can they get back in this race and possibly take the nomination at this point?
I don't believe that Dr. Carson is going to be one of those who has that in his immediate future. But I do feel that active governors and a number of governors who used to be in office, like Jeb Bush, for example, still have a shot. And they have a shot because we're going from the caucus of Iowa to the primary in New Hampshire. Primaries are very different, and the people in New Hampshire are very different from the voters in Iowa. They're very unpredictable. They can cross ballot. They can be Democrats voting for Republican and vice versa. And they may very well feel that the country has had a splendid show in Iowa. Now let's get serious. And when they go into New Hampshire, they may be looking at Bush in a fresh way. They may be looking at Christie in a fresh way. They may be looking at Kasich of Ohio in a fresh way. And he is the most remarkable, in my judgment, of the entire group. He is an active governor, as is Christie in New Jersey, but he's in Ohio. And if you go back into our history, there are two states at the end of the counting that are always fundamentally important. One of them is Florida, and one of them is Ohio. And if you have the governor of Ohio at the top of your ticket, you're a lot better off than having an ex-governor of Florida. So we're going to learn a great deal in New Hampshire as we go through this week and the actual vote next Monday.
You know, I keep saying, Marvin, whoever the candidate is on the Republican side, just the way the geography is of the electoral map, they almost have to pick the former governor of Florida, the governor of Ohio, or even Marco Rubio if he doesn't get the nomination, because you've got to have somebody who is very popular in one of those states if you are a Republican to get to the presidency.
Yeah, and that makes a good bit of sense. And we're going to see exactly how that plays out. And that gives Jeb Bush that extra oomph, that extra degree of life. I'm not sure that he would accept the vice presidency, but let's see what happens. And that certainly gives Marco Rubio a big push. He earned that push last night in Iowa, because he came not out of nowhere, but he did come from a not terribly privileged position to jump into the third place in Iowa among the Republicans. And he was only 1 point behind, if my memory serves me right, only 1 point behind Trump, who was in second place. So you've got Marco Rubio is now the darling of the establishment, the people who feel he's enough of an outsider but very much within the system, and he is young and he is bright, clearly. He speaks very well in debates. So maybe he's the guy the Republicans will ultimately rally around.
Just want to spend a little bit of time on the Democratic side, because that turned into kind of an interesting event. Bernie Sanders, the 74-year-old man who defines himself as a democratic socialist but is drawing crowds like nobody's business, popular with the kids, is giving a former First Lady, Secretary of State, Senator from New York, a real run for her money. Is the Democratic race, though, a foregone conclusion, with Hillary still able to edge him out in Iowa, and big discussions on whether Bernie Sanders can survive in the South?
Those are very good questions and very important questions to determine, and I wish that we all had the answer to that, because it would subtract the tension from the Democratic side. I don't think that we have seen the end of Bernie Sanders at all. What I find remarkable about him, and I did not feel about a month ago that I would be saying this now, what I find remarkable about him is that he can attract an awful lot of people who are just ordinary folks, who are people who contribute, what he said last night was an average of $27, with 3.5 million people sending in financial contributions to his campaign. That's quite remarkable. And you're talking there not just about young people, but, and here I'm guessing, middle-aged people and even older people. You're talking about a desire, this gets back to an earlier point with the Republicans, about finding somebody new. Now, Bernie Sanders is not new. He's been in politics forever and a day. He's 74 years old. He's got a rim of gray hair. He speaks as an old-fashioned labor leader, urging the crowd to do certain things. He's a charmer in a way. But you have to be interested in that kind of charm. You have to be interested in somebody who speaks like a New Yorker, and was. You have to be interested in somebody, you said in your introduction, who's a democratic socialist. The word socialist has never drawn a lot of votes in the U.S., and yet they're drawing votes around Bernie Sanders. Maybe it's because Hillary Clinton is regarded as too old line. Bernie Sanders representing something new. That's silly. He doesn't represent anything new. But what he does represent is something different. And again, the American people are eager for something different, something new, something out of the box, and Bernie is most certainly out of the box.
Last question about last night, and maybe it's the most looming question of this election so far. A former First Lady, former Secretary of State, former Senator from the biggest city in the world, New York, state, I should say. She just starts out big every time. People wait to hear her announcement. She gives a big announcement. And then we get to these things, and Martin O'Malley's gone as of last night. He suspended his campaign, so it's Bernie and Hillary till we get to July. What is Hillary Clinton's problem where as people get to the voting machines, as people get to the caucuses, she just starts to become unpopular with the country?
We can carry that a bit too far. We have to remember that she did, in 2008, quite well in any number of states, and quite well with large, important groups within the Democratic caucus. However, you are right in pointing out a problem that has haunted Hillary Clinton from the very beginning of her husband's presidency. When Hillary Clinton in 1994 took on her husband's responsibility of coming up with a health care system of some kind, she became, after a while, extremely unpopular. The question, why? Because she did everything in a very secretive way. She managed to do a great deal. She's a very smart person, but she likes to operate in her own world where she is the boss, and unquestionably the boss to whom everyone turns. And I think that that leads to, as well, a feeling very strong in her mind that the experience that she and her husband had with the mainstream press in the early 1990s, leading to the scandal that was exposed with Monica Lewinsky, the Clintons believe that she uses the term right-wing conspiracy, and that's probably far too strong a term, but there are a lot of people who, ever since she became a public figure in the 1990s as First Lady, ever since that time, any number of people, we don't know exactly how many, don't like her. And so they ascribe to her all kinds of awful things and ignore the positive things associated with Secretary Clinton. She did a very, very competent job as Secretary of State. She was a very effective senator. And throughout her entire life, she has stood for many of the things that she's now running for as presidential candidate. But these other qualities do haunt her, and they're around at all times. Distrust. Is she lying? What is she really up to? This degree of distrust, of questioning, has always been around Hillary Clinton, and she's going to learn herself before this year is out whether the American people are prepared to vest their trust and faith in her as President of the United States.
We're chatting with Marvin Kalb, a legendary journalist and author of the great new book, Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, and we're going to get into that momentarily, but there are just a few questions I've got to ask Marvin since this is the first time he's been on the show. You were the last Murrow boy recruited by Edward R. Murrow. What was Murrow like?
Murrow was a great journalist, a gentleman, highly experienced, extraordinarily curious about the world, somebody who brought me into the CBS family essentially because I had studied Russian history. I, for a time, taught Russian history. I knew the language. And he wanted somebody in Russia. We were then in the middle of the Cold War. He wanted somebody representing CBS in Russia who could arrive and immediately be familiar with the history of the country, the politics of the country, the language and literature of the country. And so he offered me that opportunity, and I grabbed it, and it was one of the most wonderful experiences of my life to be able to work with somebody like Morrow.
He is the gold standard today when you talk to any journalist. Does he deserve that? Was he the gold standard?
Well, he certainly was the gold standard as far as I'm concerned. I don't know that there was anyone then or now who matches up to Morrow. When Morrow was covering World War II, he was clearly the number one journalist. He organized the CBS team in Europe, but he didn't sit back in the office while the other guys went off on dangerous missions. Morrow went off on those missions himself before he sent anybody. In other words, he was there on one bombing run after another against Germany. He was on the ground with people. He saw the war. He tried very hard to cover Britain under the German Blitz in 1941-42. He did that, I think, brilliantly, and some of the broadcasts, which are available on the Internet now, which he delivered during the war or immediately after the war, are broadcasts that ought to be listened to by anybody who pretends to be a journalist or wishes to earn his living on the radio. Take a listen, for example, to a broadcast that he did in mid-April of 1945, when, with a group of reporters and General Eisenhower, visited the Nazi death camp at Buchenwald. And what he saw there staggered him. He could not believe in the horror of what he had seen. And unlike other reporters, Morrow took 3 days, as he explained later, to find the words that would adequately express what he had seen. And when you listen to that broadcast today, and I repeat, it could be heard on the Internet, you realize what news reporting on radio could be like and could still be like if people chose to follow that kind of an example. So Morrow was very special, deserves all of the honors. I myself carry a professorship at Harvard called the Edward R. Morrow Professor, and it is a tenured professorship. It's the only one in the country that is tenured, and I am deeply, deeply honored to be able to hold that title.
Marvin, in your career, another interesting thing, you ended up on President Nixon's enemies list. How did that happen, and did you think that was deserved?
Well, absolutely not deserved. I mean, that's absurd to imagine that if you do a broadcast that is somewhat critical of a presidential policy on the war in Vietnam, that the president would take it into his head to imagine that you are an enemy, and an enemy of your country. That's absurd. But Nixon was a very brilliant man in many ways, but also an extremely troubled man. And he imagined that people who disagreed with him were somehow enemies. He would think in these large apocalyptic terms. Criticism is not being an enemy. Criticism is an asset. Every president should listen to criticism. No president is so omniscient as to know everything about every issue in the world. So if somebody says in a broadcast, "Mr. President, people in your own government disagree with what you are saying and explaining to the American people," I think what a sensible man would do would be to listen to that. So the idea of being on an enemies list to begin with is idiotic, but that is what Nixon would do on occasion. He would do odd things.
Now, being on an enemies list, what did that mean? They kept an eye on you. They didn't give you information that
What it meant is, first of all, not everybody even in the government even knew that there was an enemies list. This was a White House nuttiness. And the people very close to Nixon in the White House knew about an enemies list. So that if you were on it, and let's say there was an opportunity of doing a favor for one journalist as opposed to another, they would obviously give it to the journalist who had never been critical of the president. In fact, had been filled with praise for the president. I mean, that is a logical, completely understandable human judgment. This is different, though. This was a reflection of a deep insecurity in a man like Nixon, who was in so many ways a brilliant foreign policy strategist, and yet when it came to things like simple criticism, simply could not take it.
One of your students, biggest name in cable news for the last 20 some odd years now, Bill O'Reilly. When you look at your former student, what do you think of him today?
Well, first of all, I think that Bill's success is quite extraordinary. And what he was able to do and what he continues to do on Fox is unusual, remarkable. And if you like his point of view, you will regard him as a kind of journalistic god. And if you don't like his point of view, you would regard him as a menace. I found that as a student, putting aside all of the projected future of Bill O'Reilly, as a student back then, he was bright, quick, and the only negative, and it was a large negative, was that Bill tended to arrive at a problem with his mind already firmly made up. So he was doing a term paper for me about the coverage of the Vietnam War, Time Magazine's coverage. He had already made up his mind that it was awful and that it did not provide enough pluses for the U.S. government. And no matter what kind of research he did, and I urged him to do more and more research, he always ended up with the same conclusion that he brought into my office at the very beginning of the semester. That's the negative on Bill. The positive on him, we see every night on television.
You are a former host of Meet the Press. How do you feel the Sunday shows did back in your time as host of Meet the Press as opposed to today? Do you think they're still doing their job?
Well, Absolutely. I think they're terribly important shows, and I hope that they continue to do their job for a long, long time. They're different today from the way they were in my time in the mid-80s. In the mid-80s, we were very content to have a major figure being interviewed by three or four reporters, and we could stay with that major figure for the entire hour or half hour, whatever it happened to be. In my day in the mid-80s, Meet the Press was a half-hour program. It became an hour program when Tim Russert did it in the 1990s. But in my time, we were thrilled to have a Secretary of State spend the half hour with us. That is not possible today. There's an assumption that programs such as Meet the Press will make that people can only tolerate 5, 6, 7 minutes of a Secretary of State, and then they have to move on. And then they have to move on to a panel mostly of journalists who say generally that the Secretary of State didn't know what he was talking about, rarely that the Secretary of State said it right. There is a tendency to be overly critical about guests among the journalists who are there, the pundits who are brought onto the program. It's a different the programs today are reflections of the people's mood today, the way in which the big shots in New York or Washington or Atlanta decide what it is that the American people really want without giving them an opportunity to say anything. That may be too strong a criticism, I'm not sure, but my gut feeling is that the American people can tolerate a lot more than 6 or 7 minutes of a major figure.
We're chatting with legendary journalist and author of the great new book, Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War, Marvin Kalv. Marvin, let's get to this book, because this is a fascinating book. What made you write this?
Well, please remember, going back to a point I was making earlier, I have been absorbed with the study of Russia ever since World War II, when I was a kid. And at this point in my life, I'm not apt to change. My tastes are going to remain pretty much the same. I have written 14 books. Imperial Gamble is my 14th. When the Russians, under Putin's leadership, moved in and seized and occupied Crimea in February of 2014, exactly 2 years ago, I was astonished by that move. I thought it was in violation of everything that the world had kind of implicitly agreed to since the end of the Cold War in 1991. And why was Putin doing this? What was on his mind? What was he seeking to do? And I am associated as a senior fellow with Brookings, which is a think tank in Washington, which has its own publishing operation. And the woman who runs the publisher, sort of reading my mind, called me one day, said, let's go to lunch, and before the lunch was over, had popped the question, would I sit down and write a book that attempts to explain Putin, this extraordinary, dangerous man who runs Russia today? Who is he? What is it that he really wants? Is he dangerous to the point of bringing the U.S. and Russia back into a new Cold War, back into perhaps a military confrontation? And so I spent the next year and a half reading everything that Putin had said or written, interviewing Russians, interviewing Ukrainians, trying to find out the true story behind the Russian move into Ukraine, and then I wrote the book as quickly as I could, and the book has been out for a couple of months now and has been very well received, and I'm delighted that so many Americans are interested in reading about this terribly important man and what it is that he's doing in different parts of the world, not only Ukraine, but in Syria, and God knows, perhaps even in the Baltic.
You know, Marvin, I think a lot of people got confused about Putin because here we had Gorbachev and Reagan, and he got together, and that marked the end of the Soviet Union, and that went away. And then Yeltsin came in, and we thought that Russia now is very diminished, certainly not a superpower, not on our level. And Yeltsin did interviews with Western media, Barbara Walters, people of that nature. And then he passes away. A lot of people considered him an alcoholic. And then here comes Putin. And he does interviews with a lot of Western media in the beginning. He talked to Barbara Walters. He talked to Larry King. Seemed like a very rational guy. And most things, the only thing most people, I think, knew about him was that he was a former member of the KGB, because that seemed to be brought out so often. What happened to Vladimir Putin, what happened to him from the time when he was doing these interviews on Western television and it was very contained over there, to now he's making a move?
I would stress 2 points, and we could go into more detail, but one point is that when he became president of Russia in the year 2000, it's now 16 years. He was prime minister for 4 of those years. But in that period of time, he, like many, many people who acquire enormous political power, likes of being the number one person in Russia. It's reached a point where I suspect that when he shaves in the morning, if indeed he still shaves himself in the morning, he looks in the mirror and says, "My God, you're gorgeous, and my God, you're the most fantastic ruler Russia has ever had." He fancies himself a mix, and I say this in the book a couple of times and back it up with fact. He says a couple of times and acts a couple of times as if he is a mix of Peter the Great and Stalin. In other words, somebody reaching out to the West, somebody wanting to build and expand Russia's power, and somebody who was a total dictator. That's one aspect. When you are that kind of a totalitarian leader, the only thing in your mind is the retention of your political power. The second point is that Putin, like any Russian leader, whether it's Peter the Great or Stalin, any Russian leader, looks first and foremost upon what is in the best interest of Russia, not the rest of the world, the best interests of Russia. And when the people in Ukraine, at the tail end of 2013, began to demonstrate in the tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands, in Kiev, shouting that they wanted democracy, that they wanted nothing to do with Russia any longer, Putin regarded that as an existential threat, not only to his own command of political power, but to the interests of Russia. And so he decided then and there, and it's written in some detail in the book, and I don't think it's anywhere else, the way in which Putin decided to use the army and to use his special forces in order to crush any pro-Western sentiment in Ukraine. He doesn't care about what's going. People can make whatever speeches they like in Ukraine. He pays no attention to that. But when he feels that Ukraine is breaking away from a Russian embrace toward the West, he regards that as an existential threat to Russia, and he fully intends to crush it. And he puts boots on the ground to prove that he's going to crush it. That is where those two points, where Putin is like any other Russian leader, he will do what is best for Russia, and like many other Russian leaders, when he is persuaded that he's God's gift to Russia, he becomes even more dictatorial than he was the day before.
What does he ultimately, in your opinion, want to achieve?
I think his aims are both large and small at the same time. And what I mean by that is Putin is not a communist. He's not a fascist, not a Democrat, not a Republican. He's not part of any political party, though he has formed a political party. He is who he is. He is the leader of Russia. And like a czar in the old days, he is the one who will determine what Russia is going to do in the short term. That is what is so centrally important to him. And when one asks the question, what is he up to? What does he really want at the end of the day? He wants Russia to be a great power once again. He wants Russia to be respected. He wants Russia, the word respect is terribly important to him. He wants Russia to be looked upon as a country of great science, of great literature. And he wants Russia, the Russian people, to feel secure. And to feel secure, they have to be dominant in their sphere of influence. Now, people in the West say Russia has no right to have a sphere of influence. If Ukraine wishes to be independent, it should be independent. Well, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. I totally agree with it. But if you're looking at the reality of the situation, Russia has always been not in control of necessarily, but has had significant influence over the activities of those countries immediately on its border. So long as that region immediately on its border does not represent a threat as he sees it to Russia, he can live with that. But he is he's a tricky man. He is in many ways a sophisticated thug, but he is also somebody who has more or less absolute power in Russia, and he is somebody, therefore, who has to be dealt with. I hope that we can deal with him in an intelligent way.
Does he have the firepower to reestablish what he wants to reestablish? And are we paying close enough attention to him? He comes up in the debates, primary debates, more often than any other world leader. So it seems we're aware of it, but are we really aware of it?
Well, we're aware of it on a very superficial level. I think, Scott, that's what you're getting at. We're not aware of it in the sense of understanding the history of Russia, understanding the history of Ukraine, understanding the history of Russian political power. Again, one of the reasons that I did Imperial Gamble was to try to fill in that hole, that if Americans who like to read books, Americans who are interested in world affairs, Americans who are interested in politics, probably would like to take a look at this book because it was written essentially for them. And it was written with a view toward explaining the very questions that you are now asking about Putin. Let it rest with, I hope, rest with the knowledge that we are at this point in the West, in the United States, dealing with an adversary who is very tough, very smart, cunning, determined to use military power if necessary to reacquire respect for Russia and to reacquire security in the immediate area around Russia so that he can tell the Russian people that under my leadership you are now secure. Most of the Russians are prepared to tell any pollster that Putin is the greatest guy who's ever lived, and so you have 86-90% approval ratings. But when you're that high in any literate country, you know that the polling numbers are meaningless, and they're meaningless in Russia as well. Putin has power, and that's why Russians look to him, and Russians who feel insecure want to have the Russian word voiced, want to have a leader who is supreme, who is tough. And they're prepared, the Russian people are very interesting, and this has been true for hundreds of years. If a Russian leader provides them with personal, family, and national security, they're prepared to give up personal liberty. Liberty comes in second place. That has always been the case in Russia. It is not, fortunately, the case in this country. But that is essentially the best way of understanding him.
With 1 minute,
in any case, I'm losing my voice.
With 30 seconds left to go, yeah, we're getting ready. With 30 seconds left to go, and I'll just give you a one word answer or one chance to answer in one word. Is he the biggest threat to the United States today?
Yes. Yes, I think that is the case.
The book is Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War. Boy, did we just scratch the surface here today. You'll have to get this book by the great Marvin Kalb to understand so much more. Marvin, thank you so much for giving us so much time and so much very, very literate understanding of a lot of things going on in our world today. You're a terrific guest, and I hope you come back in the future.
Scott, that would be my pleasure, and if I'm a terrific guest, that's because you're a terrific interviewer.
That's high praise. Thank you, Mr. Kalb.
Okie doke.
Bye-bye. Marvin Kalb, former host of Meet the Press, and again, the book is Imperial Gamble, Putin, Ukraine, and the New Cold War. You might want to learn about what's going on. Coming up in hour number two today, 40th Treasurer of the United States, Mary Ellen Withrow, on everything that happened last night in Iowa. and as we head to New Hampshire. You're not going to want to miss this, and we'll probably get you on the line in the bottom half of the hour. So stay tuned to WWGH Radio. We're having a lot of fun discussing a lot of very, very interesting things. We're online, www.wwgh1071.com. Be back.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FLP.